Welcome to a podcast brought to you by the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. Our academy is a national organization committed to excellence in orthopedic manual physical therapy practice, education, and research. And we're here to explore a wide range of topics with you through interviews with content experts.
Hello, my name is Stephen Schaefer, and I'm excited to bring to you another informative interview from the 2021 AAMPT Conference. This time, our guest is Dr. Emily Grieshaber. Dr. Grieshaber is both a board-certified cardiovascular and pulmonary specialist, as well as a recent fellow of our academy. She currently works in Jonesboro, Tennessee, and she has both extensive education in musculoskeletal services, as well as managing patients experiencing COVID-19. In fact, the presentation we're going to discuss today is Providing Musculoskeletal Care to the Post-COVID Community. This is going to be our first conversation talking directly about the management of patients with COVID-19, and I'm certainly excited to see where it takes us. So, without any further delay, let's get to the interview. Dr. Grieshaber, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am excellent, and I'm very excited to have you on the show today. In fact, it's one of those topics that I'm both personally and professionally, let's say, quite intrigued by. There's this amazing intersection between the world of this pandemic virus that we've all been dealing with and then the published evidence as it relates to outpatient physical therapy services. Speaking of which, I'd like to kick things off by having you tell our audience a little bit about what it's been like as a physical therapist who's working in current time, so during this pandemic, with both an interest in musculoskeletal and cardiopulmonary services.
Well, I can tell you that the last couple years of my life, like everybody else, has been kind of a roller coaster of events. Because when COVID-19 first came about, I was actually doing my residency at the VA in St. Louis. So I was about halfway through my residency when COVID-19 came to the United States. And so it was really a unique opportunity for me to get my hands dirty right when this thing started. So I was able to participate in creating protocols for these patients and kind of following up after they had recovered and moved on from the nursing home phase. And then as I transitioned out of my residency, I went into an orthopedic manual physical therapy fellowship in which my experience was all outpatient focused. And I hadn't worked in an outpatient environment for a couple of years. So it was really a unique experience because I got to see all sides of COVID-19. I got to see individuals that were in acute care, then going on to inpatient rehab, and then going to the outpatient phase. I've gotten to see individuals through telehealth, which has been really unique. So I think it's just been a really great opportunity for me as a therapist to get creative in how I treat and manage these patients, and a really great opportunity for me to educate other providers on why our services are so important and why we really need to be on the forefront of treating these individuals.
That sounds like an amazingly unique experience. It's certainly quite different from my pandemic professionally. On this end of things, instead of actually diving into the roles, for example, in inpatient therapy, initially my clinic was shut down for 2.5 months. And then we got to slowly ease our way back in with these ebbs and flows of general outpatient work. But I'll admit, I think this topic is just wonderful and fascinating. So there's a part of me that's super jealous about all of that experience.
I am lucky for sure. I didn't think with the cardiopulmonary experience, the fellowship was going to be something in my future, but I'm so glad that it was, because I think that's really where I found my interest and found what I'm best at clinically.
Well, that's amazing. And before we get too sidetracked, can you talk to us about the whole COVID-19 pathophysiological process? And since that's a really grandiose topic, let's start with how the virus, SARS-CoV-2, is impacting the human body from a medical perspective.
Sure. So as we know, it's a respiratory virus. And once it is in your lungs, it acts on the ACE2 receptor, the angiotensin converting enzyme 2 receptor, which is normally responsible for breaking down angiotensin 2 to angiotensin 1. Angiotensin 2 is something that's normally produced in the body, and it acts on a bunch of different body systems, like it acts on the kidneys, the heart, the vasculature, all of that to regulate blood pressure and blood volume. If you remember the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, that's where we see angiotensin 2 really come into play. So what we're seeing is because that receptor is typically responsible for breaking down angiotensin 2 and relieving the body of those effects, in patients with COVID-19, we actually see a buildup of angiotensin 2, which results in dysfunction of those body systems. So that's why we see things like nausea and vomiting or GI symptoms. We see cardiomegaly, arrhythmias, kidney failure, and even cerebrovascular disease, because those receptors are all throughout the body, not just in the lung tissue. So while COVID-19 is a respiratory virus and causes things like pulmonary edema and viral pneumonia, it can also cause a lot of other dysfunction within the body, which can make medical management of these patients extremely difficult.
That's truly fascinating, and it really does begin to describe why so many different body systems are impacted. And as a follow-up, I didn't hear you yet mention the musculoskeletal impacts of the virus. So is it that same process that's going to lead the patient towards having MSK symptoms, or is there something else going on there? And what are those actual orthopedic impacts?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of unique research around that subject. And so when anybody has an inflammatory response within the body, it negatively impacts the musculoskeletal system. Typically, we'll see myalgias and arthralgias in anybody with some sort of inflammation, like a pneumonia or an influenza, not just in patients with COVID-19. But there has been some research that's come out to show that there are those ACE2 receptors located in skeletal muscle, cartilage, and bone synovium. And so there is the potential for direct viral infiltration within those tissues, but we just don't have enough information yet to prove that that's really going on. On the other side of that, there's been some research to look at imaging of these tissues. So they've seen nerve enlargement, muscle edema, muscle atrophy, joint effusion, osteoporosis, and things of that nature. But typically, those studies have been done in individuals that have been in the hospital for a prolonged period of time or have more of a severe COVID-19 infection. So again, it's tricky to really tell if that's the result of a chronic illness or is it the result of COVID-19 infection itself.
So as per usual, the scene in a healthcare situation is a bit complicated. And of course, with something this new, the evidence is still forthcoming. I mean, if you had a perfectly confident answer that outlined everything, I would probably think you were lying and making it up.
Yeah, it's definitely a gray area. And I'm sure we've all kind of heard that throughout our physical therapy profession, that it's a gray area, no matter what you're talking about, but certainly the musculoskeletal impact. But if you think of these individuals, I don't tend to think of just the direct impact on the musculoskeletal system. I tend to think about these patients' stories. And so how long were they in the hospital for? And we know how prolonged bed rest can impact skeletal muscle and bones and joints and how these folks are moving. I know we're going to talk a little bit about some of the thoracic and rib changes that we're seeing in those individuals or that I've seen in the clinic. So it's more those indirect effects that I think are really important for us to understand as physical therapists.
I think that sounds wise. And regardless of being a gray area or not, I know that your presentation dove a little bit into what's called the Stanford Hall Consensus Statement for post-COVID-19 rehabilitation. Can you tell our audience a little bit about what it says?
Yeah, so this was, there's honestly not a lot of research out there that tells us how to manage patients in the outpatient setting. And so when I looked at that presentation, I really wanted to provide something to outpatient therapists, which typically most orthopedic physical therapists are. They work in that setting. There's a lot of stuff for the acute side and even the inpatient rehab side that we can pull from, and not so much on the outpatient side. So this was great that this came out. This statement focused on a target population of athletes and military personnel and provides recommendations for those folks following discharge. So, for instance, it states things about how many MET levels we should be exercising these individuals at. It also indicates that we should be screening for psychological and underlying medical concerns during recovery. And what I really like about this statement is that it advocates for cardiopulmonary rehab, which I don't think is important just for the athletic or the healthy population, but for any population that has had COVID-19, that may be something that we can really push for in the future.
That sounds like a useful resource, and I'll make an attempt to link to it in the show notes. In addition to that resource, What is added to the topic by looking at the interim guidelines that were authored by the International Task Force that was published in the European Respiratory Journal, which I'll add as another thing that you mentioned during your presentation at our AAMPT conference?
Yeah, so same thing. This really attempts to kind of bridge the gap for outpatient physical therapists. So when you're seeing these folks after they've discharged, this gives you an idea of really where to start in your rehab process. It encourages more of a formal physical assessment, roughly 6 to 8 weeks after they've discharged, to identify any physical deficits, which I would add is probably really important for anybody with a prolonged hospitalization. And then you can also follow up with a measure of exercise capacity, so something like the 6-minute walk test. So again, just kind of gives you some guidelines on what to look for in your initial evaluation of these folks and some useful measures to use and track over time.
So you've already started to talk a little bit about those health-related variables that we can be testing in this patient population. Can you give us a little bit of a broader or deeper dive into what those tests and measures can include?
The APTA came out with a core application algorithm that identifies a bunch of different tests and measures that we can look at in this population. Again, I feel like that algorithm is more acute care and inpatient rehab focused, but it gives you a really great guideline to follow. And you can kind of see how it flows from assessing the cognitive component of the patient, assessing the quality of life of the patient, and then moving into more functional assessments of strength and endurance. So as long as you kind of keep those categories in mind, you can use this across any setting. And so first things first, they start with cognition. I think they mentioned, you know, the CAM ICU is a really big one, really popular one. So they start there to make sure your patient can cognitively participate in the evaluation. And then they move into more of a quality of life assessment. You can find a ton of different resources for that. I think in the outpatient side, at least what I've seen in my patient population, a lot of them are very depressed, very discouraged with how things are going. They are frustrated that they haven't been able to enjoy family events. They're very fearful. And so considering the quality of life in these patients is extremely important because that's where we can make our biggest impact. In terms of looking at your endurance and strength assessments, they talk a little bit about the 30-second sit-to-stand, a tug, you know, again, a bunch of tools that we already utilize in these patients, but use them consistently for that patient population so you can really track your outcomes over the long term. Another one that I tend to use is the short performance physical battery because it looks at balance, it looks at gait speed, it looks at 5 times sit to stand. So I think it's a really good all-encompassing measure to use. But again, use that as your guideline, that algorithm as your guideline, and you can kind of plug in whatever test or measure is appropriate, depending on your patient.
I like how you mentioned the fact that these can oftentimes be followed from the acute into, let's say, the subacute and outpatient settings. And hopefully for the people that have access, let's say in a university setting or in a hospital, maybe they can even acquire the previous data from inpatient therapists. And then not only see the progress from inpatient to outpatient, but then truly compare start to finish from, you know, when we first assess these variables to when we're preparing for discharge to normal community participation from an outpatient clinic.
Absolutely. And I think that's a really big advantage of where I work now. I'm in the VA in Johnson City. And so it's very easy to compile all of that data because we have access to the acute care notes. We have access to the nursing home documentation. We have access to the outpatient notes. So if you have that connection with different hospitals or clinics around you, it would be a really, really useful resource to have so you can track those in the long term.
Yeah, that's great. And as we're progressing through this conversation, let's bring it a little bit more towards an area that I have a lot more experience in. And that is, when these patients arrive in the outpatient setting, should we be using manual therapy with them? And if so, is there any way in which that's going to be different than non-COVID-19 patients?
I wouldn't say there's much of a difference in non-COVID-19 patients, simply because the techniques are very much the same. I would say maybe the area of focus is a little bit different. So for those not really familiar or comfortable with rib mobilizations or thoracic mobilizations, that would be a place that I would start to get very comfortable if you're starting to see a shift in your clientele and you're treating more post-COVID-19 individuals. but I certainly feel that manual therapy plays a very important role in the recovery of these patients. And I've used it on most individuals that I've seen post COVID-19, especially those complaining of neck and shoulder pain or still complaining of shortness of breath. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of research out there to show the benefits of manual therapy when it's used on individuals with restrictive lung dysfunction. So when we think of lung dysfunction, there's two types. There's restrictive, where you can't really get air into the lungs. And then there's obstructive, where you have a difficult time getting air out of the lungs. So that's more of your COPD population. There's a ton of research that looks at manual therapy in the COPD population. And to some extent, it's beneficial, but not on the other end of the spectrum. So if you're interested in manual therapy, you're comfortable with it, and you're interested in the research aspect, we need this information. I've seen the benefits of it in my own clinic, but that's just been my experience. I don't have any concrete evidence to say that it is useful for those folks.
Well, this is often the case. You know, as we said earlier, this is an emerging area, but it's also an emerging area of evidence that's sitting on top of other areas of medical evidence that aren't fully defined in terms of what works best and what doesn't work best. So I think that's an interesting and phenomenal call to action for researchers out there. And of course, it brings us back to a general broad point about how that's related to a lot of what we do in the clinic. So I would imagine you, for example, in your clinical practice, are using a test, treat, retest model so that you can figure out what works for that patient on that day, in that setting, for that impairment. Is that correct?
Correct. So something that I find simple to use is the Borg dyspnea scale. So you might perform a 6-minute walk test or a 2-minute walk test. You could even create your own outcome measure. You could do kettlebell squats or something of that nature. I'm all about getting creative in the clinic as long as that test is really testing what you're after. And then assessing the patient's shortness of breath after doing that activity using the Borg dyspnea scale. It's a simple 0 to 10 scale, very much so like the RPE scale, but it just looks at shortness of breath. So maybe we look at that day one, and then maybe the next time they come in the clinic or even that day, we do some rib mobilizations, we loosen up their thoracic spine, we mobilize the first rib so that they can use their accessory muscles appropriately, and then we do that same test and assess their shortness of breath after that activity again. So I think it's a very easy thing to do. It's like anything that we do in the clinic. If we're noticing their knee is not flexing the way we need it to be, let's mobilize it and then remeasure and see where we're at. So the same concept applies. You just have to have the right resource.
Hopefully that's the type of answer that's going to make some of our audience feel more comfortable about working with these patients. It isn't like they have to learn a 100% new skill set. But if we can dive a little bit deeper into some variables that might be new to the audience. How many people, if you know, that are afflicted with COVID-19 are experiencing so-called long-haul symptoms?
So right now, the data shows about 10% of individuals with COVID-19 are experiencing long-haul symptoms or post-COVID syndrome, as some refer to it. It's called about 5 different things. But most of those individuals have a very, very good prognosis. And I think it's important to note that most of those individuals have a comorbidity. So unfortunately, we have seen that individuals with one or more comorbidities are at a higher risk of mortality with COVID-19. So this, I think, is another call to action of physical therapists to really look at the health status of the individual sitting in front of you. Don't just look at them from an orthopedic standpoint, but look at them as the whole patient and how can we really improve the whole health of the patient sitting in front of you. Like I said, a lot of these folks still have a very good prognosis. They typically continue to complain of fatigue and pain more often than not. And in my patients, I have seen some individuals that complain of shortness of breath, which is another one of kind of the top 5 symptoms, I would say, that are present in these individuals. But again, really good prognosis with these folks and treat it just like anybody who is kind of deconditioned. Just be hyper aware that the pulmonary system has been affected in these folks.
That sounds like excellent advice. And I know you're currently working in a relatively unique setting that's not necessarily going to transfer over to people like myself that work in a more general outpatient setting. However, I'm curious to know, how many of these patients with post-COVID syndrome are you currently working with?
Well, I can say that the majority of the veterans that I have seen have had COVID at one point or another, and mix that in with the individuals that I'm seeing via telehealth as well, I would say the large majority have had COVID at one point or another. Those that come in with specific complaints of fatigue and shortness of breath, that one's a little bit harder to pin down because they're typically referred to me for something else. So it's up to me as the physical therapist to ask them those questions about their COVID history. I want to get the full story. I want to know if they were hospitalized. I want to know how long they were there. I want to know if they had supplemental oxygen therapy or if they were on a ventilator. I want to know how they're doing now cognitively. I'm assessing my yellow flags. Are they depressed? Are they anxious? Are they fearful? You know, all of those things really come into play. So I would say roughly 50% of my patient population right now that I'm working with have some complaints of that. I would say that more often than not, though, their main focus in treatment is the reason why they're referred. So it's a little bit trickier to kind of tailor my treatment strategies to meet both.
Isn't that just another way in which the population is in, I guess, a very large fashion, very similar to everyone else we deal with in outpatient therapy? You know, just because a prescription says sciatica or whatever, it doesn't mean that that's where we're going to end up focusing on. Our job is to be thorough and to ask a lot of questions, to have good intake paperwork, and then to figure out the true nature of the situation, because a lot of times either the people coming to us don't know or the people referring them to us don't know the whole story. So that's our job. That's what we do as expert clinicians, you know, as people trained by these programs that are representing the academy.
Absolutely. And I think another challenge is sometimes getting the patient on board with it. A lot of times they don't want to revisit what they've been through already, or they just want to get their visits over with and get out of physical therapy because they're missing work or they're missing time with family, whatever the case may be. So I think it's almost a little bit more challenging to try and get the patient on board with what you're identifying as an expert clinician and saying, hey, even though you're coming to me for shoulder pain, it might be related to COVID-19 and your past infection, and you've still got some deficits that I'm seeing in your leg strength, or you still complain of shortness of breath. Why can't we treat all of these at the same time? And so I think if you really get that buy-in with your patient and you really make a conscious effort to utilize interventions that encompass everything, the reason why they're there and maybe the reason why they're not, then you're going to have the biggest benefit in the clinic.
That's great. I love it. It sounds like the way a true expert would approach a clinical situation. And speaking of that, can you talk to us a little bit about the types of interventions? And I know you've already mentioned some of them, like rib mobilization, but talk a little bit more in depth about what you're doing with this population and maybe, you know, which things you feel work the best.
Yeah, so I love, obviously, I'm a manual therapist, so I use manual therapy a lot on these individuals. Depending on the population, you know, I might use more manual on some than others. For example, some of my older individuals, it's harder to get them in certain positions for a long period of time. So I might instruct them in how to do self-mobilizations versus when I was actually in my fellowship training, I saw some younger individuals with post-COVID-19 syndrome. And so I would use more thoracic manipulations or cervical manipulations if need be, things of that nature. But I would say more commonly, I'm using self-rib mobilizations to teach the patient how to do that at home. So for example, I've had them use like a bed sheet around their rib cage. And as they exhale, they can kind of close that in a little bit. And as they inhale, they really extend back and over the chair and take their arms out to get the chest wall moving a little bit. I would say the most important thing that I've seen work for these folks is anything that encourages chest expansion while they inhale and then closing that chest wall down when they exhale to really focus on the trunk and get that a little bit more mobile. I've also seen some shoulder pain and neck pain in these folks too. So I've done some shoulder strengthening or some shoulder mobilizations, some self snags, you know, of the cervical spine. So I kind of get creative as far as the manual therapy aspect. In terms of interventions, think global strengthening. So I don't focus on a single muscle because those individuals will tire out much more quickly if I just focus on one muscle versus focusing on a larger muscle group. So doing kettlebell squats or somewhat like a thruster maneuver where they squat with a dumbbell and then press up overhead. I'm incorporating multiple joints. I'm accomplishing multiple goals doing that. So I try to involve as much of the body as I can and try to mimic activities that they might be doing at home anyway. So it really depends on the patient, and you have to identify what might be meaningful to them, because if they just feel like they're getting a workout but don't really see how it's going to translate to their well-being in the future, you might not get the results that you're really looking for.
That's an absolutely perfect transition, because my next question is, what type of outcomes are you seeing with this patient population?
I'm seeing some really great outcomes, to be honest. I think the fatigue is probably the biggest thing that patients still really struggle with in those individuals with post-COVID syndrome. But in general, I mean, these individuals are highly functional. They're going back to living their normal lives. I will say those individuals with more psychosocial factors present is a bit more of a challenge, just because they really need a multidisciplinary team. So if you're able to reach out to a psychologist or give them some resources to reach out to themselves, I think that's the best way to go about it. So I think, and we see that in the orthopedic population in general, if somebody has a lot of yellow flags, their prognosis might not be as good as somebody who doesn't demonstrate those factors. But in individuals that don't have those yellow flags, I do see that they return to full function, go back to work, hanging out with their family, and they usually do very, very well.
That's great. That's exactly, of course, what we want to hear. Our ultimate goal is and should always be to get our patients back to a normal functional participation in life. And for those of us that are less familiar with this area of clinical practice, what resources, if any, would you recommend? For example, do you know of any classes that are available? Should people go do a residency? Should they stick to and rely upon the training they've had during their fellowship process? Or do you think they should perhaps look closely at those guidelines and consensus statements?
I think the guidelines are a great place to start, especially if you're more of an outpatient physical therapist, because they give you a guide to follow. They kind of bridge the gap between acute care and outpatient practice and where you should start. If you have not heard of the PACER Project, that is a resource that was put forth by the Academy of Cardiovascular and Pulmonary Physical Therapy, and it is completely free. They have so many videos on a million different topics related to COVID-19, and it's all on YouTube. You literally just type PACER Project in the search bar, and the series of those videos will pop up for you, and they are all experts in the cardiopulmonary field. So they talk about respiratory muscle training. If you have access to a respiratory muscle trainer or want to know more about that, you'll get that information there. They talk about specifics to the geriatric population, specifics to the pediatric population. They talk about, you know, getting the diaphragm to activate better. It's just, there's multiple different resources available to you on that one link for YouTube. So I would totally start there, because again, it's a free resource that you have available and pretty much covers every single topic you might think of in regards to COVID-19.
Thank you for those suggestions. And as always, we will place links in the show notes. So if any listeners want to just click over to the show notes, they'll see how to quickly and easily get over to those resources. And while I have probably 1,000 other questions, we certainly cannot spend the entire day talking about this. So Dr. Grieshaber, thank you for joining us today. In addition, thank you for all the work that you're currently doing by merging these two areas of our clinical profession. I think it's wonderful what you're doing, and I have no doubt that we'll hear great things from you in the future.
Thank you so much for having me. It was an honor to be here.
This has been a production of the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. You can learn more about the Academy by visiting our website at aaompt.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching for our acronym, AAOMPT. The views and opinions expressed on the AOMPT podcast are those of the interviewers and interviewees and do not represent the official position of AOMPT. The information presented should not be used as personal health care or clinical practice advice. If you need to find an expert orthopedic physical therapist near you, then check out the Find a Fellow feature under the Public Resources tab at www.aaompt.org, which you can find in the show notes.